You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm Art Ray. Today's guest is James Mullaney, FRAS. James Mullaney, FRAS, is an astronomer, writer, lecturer, and consultant who has published more than 700 articles and 8 books on observing the wonders of the heavens, including Edgar Cayce and the Cosmos, and logged over 20,000 hours stargazing. Formerly curator of the Buell Planetarium and Institute of Popular Science in Pittsburgh, and director of the DuPont Planetarium at USCA, he served as staff astronomer at the University of Pittsburgh's Allegheny Observatory and as an editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. One of the contributors to Carl Sagan's award-winning Cosmos PBS television series, his work has received recognition over the years from such notables as Sir Arthur Clarke, Johnny Carson, and Ray Bradbury. His 50-year mission as a celestial evangelist has been to celebrate the universe, to get others to look up at the majesty of the night sky, and to personally experience the joys of stargazing. In recognition of his work, he has been elected a fellow of the prestigious Royal Astronomical Society of London. For information on his 2 professionally produced, widely acclaimed DVDs, The Heavens Declare and the new Celebrating the Universe, which features visually stunning Hubble Space Telescope images, contact him at ArcturusSJ@AOL.com. That's ArcturusSJ@AOL.com. He is a key presenter at ARE's annual 2012 conference, A New Body, A New Mind, in Virginia Beach, from July 15th to the 17th. Well, thanks for coming on the show today.
Well, my pleasure, Art, and thank you for the very kind intro. I also want to extend a warm welcome to our listeners, but before we go a step further, I must make a disclaimer. I am simply a humble stargazer, and I mean that sincerely. You can't be an astronomer and have a big head as you look out into the vastness of the universe, so it does put you in your place. I just wanted folks to know that.
Wow, well, thanks. I understand you were initially skeptical about the Edgar Cayce readings.
Yes, Art, and that's very important because as an astronomer, I want to make the point that I am open-minded, but I was skeptical, for example, about UFOs and certainly believe that the universe is teeming with life, but came to realize that talking to astronauts and that the phenomena is real. Same with astrology. You won't find an astronomer anywhere that wants to talk about astrology, but I organized a historic conference at the ARE in March of 2004 on astrology and astronomy to bring the two together, to have a dialogue, and then, of course, the Cayce readings themselves. And I'm going to tell you what really blew my mind and got me into the Cayce reading. Point I'm making is that I am open-minded, and so some of the comments I may make about 2012, I hope folks will keep that in perspective.
Well, is there something from the readings that is your favorite passage or reading?
Oh, absolutely, Art. I've been involved with the Cayce material for over 30 years, speaking at the ARE for something like 25 years, but it was only until I did the research for my book, Edgar Cayce and the Cosmos, that I really took a look at the readings from a scientific standpoint, from the latest discoveries in physics, astronomy, quantum physics, that is, cosmology. And Art, the reading that just simply electrified me and made me realize there's so much in the readings that have been overlooked from that perspective. And I just like to read it. It is Edgar Cayce's reading 1900-1. That's the 1900th reading person that was given a reading, the first reading for that person. And it's 2 paragraphs, but it's very important. And Edgar Cayce says, "Before that, we find the entity was in the land now called Carpathian. During those periods when there was the exercising activities in the land for the study of that which is professionally called today astrology or astronomy." Second paragraph, "For with the association of the entity then with one named Corpio, an extended study was made through the abilities to use the glass that was found for the interpreting of the lights from the various heavenly bodies." Art, do you know what that means? Somebody in antiquity had a telescope. And the kicker was they did not build it. The reading clearly states they found it. the telescope as we know it today, the optical telescope, wasn't invented until the early 1600s. So that was just the beginning of a total revelation throughout his readings, which I incorporated in the book.
Wow. And what truths have you identified in Mr. Casey's readings?
Oh, Art, I could. The whole book is dedicated to things like his discoveries in quantum physics. In physics, he talks about dark matter, dark energy, antimatter, anti-gravity, relativity. These things at that time weren't even discussed, most of them. Relativity was, of course, but that's from the standpoint of physics. And then you get into astronomy and cosmology. And also, I hope we'll have a chance to touch on it, the subject of life on other worlds. It's just unbelievable what's in the book. And in his reading, I keep saying the book, but I'm referring, you know, to the readings themselves, which were the source of the material in the book. And Art, a question that does come up, and this is very important, some of the hot topics today, like black holes and quasars, were not mentioned in the Casey readings. And do you know why? Because nobody thought to ask about them. Had somebody asked about black holes, quasars, pulsars, and many of the other incredible discoveries today, 30, 40 years ago, Casey was tapping into the Akashic records, and he had the information. But nobody thought or knew to ask him. I often say that if Edgar Casey were alive today, I would camp out on the front door of the ARE and wait for him every morning.
I know that I've enjoyed, I think it was in high school. I'm not sure if it was junior high. I climbed up on top of my roof with a 200-power telescope, and it had a Barlow lens. I don't know if it was a 2-power, but I was able, even on the cheap tripod, to see Jupiter's moons. And, you know, I would observe the stars. Of course, the telescope didn't really help me with that. It was the planets, I guess, I was more interested in.
Right.
But what made you passionate about studying the stars?
Well, I was apparently here before reincarnated, you may say, okay? People have said I'm Sir William Herschel, John Brashear. These are all people that have really loved the stars very fondly. And I came into this world at the age of 5. I knew I was going to be an astronomer and was actually running up and down the streets in our neighborhood, getting people to come over and look through a telescope I had made at the age of 8. So, and Art, again, that's a good point about looking at the planets. The moon and planets are the best things to start with. And you can see so much with a pair of binoculars. Binoculars will show Jupiter's 4 bright moons if you hold them steadily and the optics are good. And with 25-30 power, you can see virtually everything in the universe you could possibly want. So it doesn't take a big telescope and a lot of power, just a desire to see the wonders of the heavens.
And, of course, perhaps driving away from the city.
Oh, yes, you're right. Unfortunately, a lot of folks are scared off of looking at the stars because they're in the city and they don't think they can see things. And obviously, the moon and planets are obvious in the middle of the brightest cities in the country. But I have also shown galaxies and quasars to people with lectures in the heart of New York City, Philadelphia, and other major metropolitan areas. It is possible, but you're right. You get away from the city lights and you will see majesty as never before.
Wow. You were part of Cosmos with Carl Sagan.
Well, I was privileged that he used some of my work in one of the episodes, yes. And I knew him, I think, quite well. He was, to me, he was a mentor, and I considered him a friend. And I'll tell you what, Art, he was a truly great man. He was the spokesman for Planet Earth. Unfortunately, he's gone. And he took a real hit from the professional community. He was criticized for being a showman. For example, he was on the Johnny Carson show 30-some times. But what people don't realize is that their funding comes from the public. And the typical astronomer, to quote one of the editors of a leading astronomy magazine, astronomy isn't boring. Astronomers are. So we owe a lot to Carl Sagan, and he's dearly missed. He was the spokesman for Planet Earth.
What episode or what information did you present, or did they use?
It was used in Episode 7, The Backbone of Night. It was about the Milky Way, but there were other portions, I guess, he used. That's the one where he targeted, the work in particular. But, as I said, I corresponded with him a lot and met him at meetings. And a lot of other people are certainly involved in Cosmos, but I was just privileged to be a small part of that.
You mentioned the Great Rift in the Milky Way. What is that?
Well, Art, it's not me mentioning it. It's the folks that are really into 2012 and all the books and programs about it. This is one of the areas I wanted to clarify, and that's why I did the thing about being an open-minded person, okay? There's a lot to do made about the Great Rift, and supposedly it's a dark highway that leads into the core of the galaxy itself. Art, misinformation is one of the things I have a problem with. There is a dark rift through the constellation Cygnus, but it's the dark material in our local spiral arm. And there's the Cygnus arm, there's the Perseus arm, there's the Orion arm, there's the Sagittarius arm, there's the Crux arm, there's the Norma arm, each going closer into the center of the galaxy. They all have dark rifts, and nobody is talking about them. It's as if there's only one dark rift, and that's the entrance to the galaxy.
Hmm. So then, could you explain this further? Do they mean that rift allows you to see farther into the center of the galaxy, or?
Well, some people have that impression that you can actually look into the core of the galaxy. We're 26,000 light years out from the core of the galaxy. It cannot be seen except by infrared and radio telescope.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with James Mullaney, FRAS.
We're 26,000 light years out from the core of the galaxy. It cannot be seen except by infrared and radio telescopes. So when you look toward the center of the Milky Way and that, you're looking at the star clouds, mostly in the spiral arms in that direction. Or this misinformation that I mentioned, I must hearken back to astrology, because I mentioned this historic conference at the ARE. As one example, astrology is based on the 12 signs of the zodiac. But the problem is there's 13. There's the constellation Ophiuchus, which lies between Sagittarius and Scorpius on the ecliptic. Sun, moon, and planets go through there all the time. And yet astrologers do not recognize. I've never met an Ophiuchan, and astrologers do not even talk about it. So this is an example where we need a dialogue, and same thing goes with the 2012 material. I think it's very symbolic what is happening. But as far as physical effects, as an astronomer, I don't see them, and I don't think they're physically possible.
What are some of the unusual alignments that will occur in 2012?
Well, Art, there's one alignment, okay, they're talking about, and I mustn't forget to talk about another alignment that nobody is mentioning, okay? The one that everyone's talking about is on December 21st, the sun will be aligned, I'm putting that in quotes, with the center of our galaxy. Art, I have a revelation. Every December 21st, on the winter solstice, the sun is aligned with the galaxy, the center of the galaxy.
Ah.
There, again, a big to-do about something that is a regular occurrence. In 2012, it will be a little more closely aligned. And again, this is an apparent alignment. It's not like the sun's being sucked into the center of the galaxy. Again, we are 26,000 light years from the core of the galaxy itself. If we have an opportunity, I'd be glad to elaborate on what a light year is, and it would really put things in perspective.
Oh, yes, the distance light travels in a year, I guess.
Yes, and everyone knows it's a big number. Light travels 186,000 miles a second, approximately. That's seven times around the Earth in a second. If you aim a flashlight at the moon, it's about less than 2 seconds. The sun's about 8 light minutes away. Pluto, at the edge of the solar system, is around 5 hours, and the nearest star other than the sun is over 4 light years away. We are now nearly 14 billion light years out. So the light year is an enormous number. It's the number 6 with 12 zeros after it. That's 6 trillion miles. And that is so meaningless that you cannot grasp it. So here's a good example. Let's say you were sitting in your favorite easy chair, and you started to count the number of miles in a light year at the rate of 1 mile per second. It would take you, unbelievably, 150,000 years to count up to the number 6 trillion, the number of miles in a light year, the astronomer's standard yardstick. We are now 14 billion of those light years out. So, as they say on Star Trek, it's a big universe, Mr. Scott.
Is this significant when Venus transits the Sun?
Yes, it is significant astronomically, and that's the one thing I mentioned that so few people talking about 2012 realize that in the midst of this year, this pivotal year, Venus is going to cross between the Sun and us. It's a very rare event. It does it in 8-year pairs, and then hundreds of years go by for it to happen again. And the last event like this was, let's see, I have the dates here. The last events, well, first of all, those interested in this should go on transitsofvenus.org, transitsofvenus.org. That's a really good website, and it has the dates and everything, the times. The last transit of Venus was in 2004, and with some safety precautions, you can see the disk of Venus slowly crossing in front of the sun, and then we will have one on June 5th to the 6th. It depends on where you are on the planet Earth, but for those in North America, June 5th before sunset, those especially in northern North America will see the entire event, but most of us will see the first couple hours before the sun sets. The next one, Art, won't occur, the next pair of transits, until 2117. So it's indeed a rare event, and you could attach some significance perhaps to the fact that this rare event is occurring right smack in the middle of 2012.
Was this predicted by the Mayans?
No, it was not. This is something modern astronomy. They were aware of Venus, and you know, and the ability to see Venus crossing the sun is a little tricky with the unaided eye, and of course we supposedly they didn't have telescopes, but they were certainly aware of the cycles of Venus, but this is, you know, modern astronomy with computers. They're able to go, you know, incredible lengths of time backward and forward, down to the nearest fraction of a second, actually, for events like this occurring, the times and the dates.
I was wondering about your presentation and your DVDs. They include many images from the Hubble telescope.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite?
I do. It's popularly called the angel image, and it shows what appears to be a flock of angels surrounding a relatively newborn baby star. And you can look at it and say it's just a bunch of gas in an unusual shape, but others see there a flock of angels. So that is one of my favorites, certainly. And Art, I think you're probably aware, and we can get onto this more perhaps, but it is a huge universe, and there's so many stars. There are actually more stars within reach of our largest telescopes today, and this is not a guess. This is a statistical calculation repeatedly done on Cray supercomputers. There are more stars within reach of our largest telescopes than all the grains of sand on all the beaches and deserts on the entire planet Earth. So talking about grains of sand, an incredible image, it's called the deep field photo, that's probably my other favorite, in a speck of sky as big as one of those sand grains held out at the end of your arm. The Hubble telescope did this incredible 100 million, it's a million seconds long exposure, and when the imaging was finished, that speck of sky showed a cluster of galaxies with 10,000 individual star cities in it, each of which contained up to half a trillion suns. So that to me, that one image is just, you know, the epitome of the infinity of the universe itself.
Are you excited by the James Webb Space Telescope that's going to be coming up?
Well, yes and no. You probably know that that's an infrared telescope, basically. They're going to be looking in the wavelengths, the infrared heat wavelengths. It'll be on the border of some visual wavelengths, but we probably won't get the kind of images we've been used to with the Hubble Space Telescope. And I do hope they'll keep the Hubble operating. It's our window on creation. It's a tremendous investment for the human race to have these images coming in day and night. So, yes, everyone's anticipating it for the research, for the discoveries that we'll make. And there'll probably be some spectacular images, but you'll be seeing them in the wavelength of the infrared wavelengths.
Do you know of a possible successor to Hubble that's going to be in the visible light spectrum?
Not really. There are none on the drawing boards that I'm aware of. We have several much smaller telescopes in orbit who are doing amazing things, such as the Kepler mission, which is up there and running. And its first report, it's designed to find, it's a planet hunter is what the nickname is. And its very first report of the initial survey, they found over 1,200 stars that have planetary systems. And the mission is just getting underway.
Modern land-based telescopes use, what is it, they use a laser system to compensate
for atmosphere? Yes, it's called adaptive optics, that's right. Mm-hmm. And what that means is we're at the bottom of a sea of atmosphere, which is continually churning, And on some nights, the stars are absolutely boiling because the images coming through have to come through the depth of the atmosphere. Thanks to modern technology, they are now able to compensate for the distortion of the image in the telescope itself before it reaches the detectors. And it's incredible, 30 times a second or more, they can actually correct the image so that it isn't affected by the atmosphere. So the bottom line here is that our ground-based telescopes now, many of them exceed the Hubble in terms of ability to give good images and also to penetrate quite deeply. And there are ground-based optical telescopes on the drawing boards now. The Keck telescopes in Hawaii, the twin binoculars are enormous, 400 inches across, but they're talking 1,000-inch telescopes now. They're on the drawing boards.
Wow, that's amazing.
It's going to be incredible.
Oh, yes.
So when you ask about a replacement for the Hubble, it might come from the ground, although I hope they never will or replace the Hubble telescope. There's no reason why it can't keep operating, at least for another 5 years, the way it looks.
Oh, yes. I know they were talking about decommissioning it. Was that 2 years ago? And then they sent up a repair crew?
Yes. They were going to let it actually tumble out of control and, eventually burn up into the ocean, which would have been a tragedy. So fortunately, in fact, there were the private sector. There were a lot of people that wanted to keep the Hubble going and said they'd pay for the repair mission. Ultimately, I guess we did through our tax money. But the point is that thank goodness they kept the Hubble going.
I was wondering, how can people get your DVDs?
Or if they send, just send me an email to the address you gave me, Arcturus SJ. Arcturus is the name of a star, and I have a little blurb that I can just forward in, by return email. And I should mention that The Heavens Declare is an inspirational journey through the cosmos, leaving no doubt that this universe is not an accident, that there is a design behind it. But the other one that's just been introduced is called Celebrating the Universe, and that is actually intended for open-eyed meditation. It has beautiful soft music in the background, and instead of me talking all the way through the thing as I do in The Heavens Declare, some people like that, I simply make a few comments about each image and leave it up long enough for folks to really soak in the majesty. So it's intended for open-eyed meditation as well as just general viewing.
Hmm. So then they can email you at ArcturusSJ@AOL.com.
Right. And right.
Mm-hmm. ArcturusSJ@AOL.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is there something in your understanding that has changed since you began working with astronomy?
Well, there's been a lot of revelations and knowledge about astronomy, our view of the universe, the sizes and the number of stars out there, the fact that all stars have planets that appears, building blocks for life throughout the cosmos. But I came into astronomy at such a young age and have attempted to keep up to it, reading journals and all that kind of thing, and actually doing research early on in my career. So there isn't a day goes by that I'm not amazed at some of the latest discoveries coming in.
We'll be right back with more with James Mullaney, FRAS. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. Let's continue our conversation with James Mullaney, FRAS.
There isn't a day goes by that I'm not amazed at some of the latest discoveries coming in, but keep up to it is just becoming harder and harder. If folks go to the Hubble site itself, there's a lot of information on there about the discoveries made with Hubble, and there are other sites also, but it's almost overload. It's really hard to keep up to the cutting-edge discoveries. I was going to hearken back to Edgar Cayce, the book itself, and his comments about life in space, because this is one of the, if not the one of the hottest topics in astronomy today. We've always wondered, are we alone in the universe? And we now know it's the universe is probably a biocosmos. It's teeming with life, and the building blocks for life are everywhere. Planets are everywhere. There's tons of water throughout the cosmos. Very common material. And folks have often said, well, Edgar Cayce was asked in two of his readings about life on other planets, and the one he just came right out and said, no, none like us. Okay. But, Art, the thing they're missing the point on is that those are questions related to the solar system. And in those two readings, he's correct. As far as we know, there's no one like us on any of the planets in the solar system. But if you get into his other readings, they are teeming with references to other worlds, other civilizations that will become children of the stars and join the galactic community, so to speak, as Carl Sagan often talked about. So there was no doubt in his mind that the universe was alive and teeming with intelligent life.
Now, you're going to be speaking at the annual 2012 conference from July 15th to the 17th, A New Body, A New Mind, 2012 and Prophecies of a New Age. What will that be like, your conference?
Well, there's quite a few. There's quite a number of different speakers. My contribution typically is, I'll be reviewing some of the things we're talking about on this program, but my contribution is my journey through the cosmos, again, using primarily Hubble images, looking at many different things, such, again, the prospects for intelligent life and so on. And Art, the thing I enjoy doing most and is the I always bring a wonderful telescope with me. It's a state-of-the-art Celestron telescope. And over the years, I would say thousands of people have had the opportunity to look through that telescope. It's an optional activity following the lecture. And if it's clear, we just simply go out on the veranda and view what is going to be in view at that time of the year. And the folks are just electrified. You should hear some of the comments. People actually, in some cases, have tears in their eyes and shout for joy, seeing the rings of Saturn and the moons of Jupiter and all the many other wonders that are out there.
Oh, yes, it's different when you look at a picture, you know, on your computer screen, and then when you actually use your own telescope to see it. You might have a lower quality image, but it's a different feeling.
Oh, you're so right. You're looking at the original handiwork of the heavens. You're not seeing a flat image. And no matter how tiny the image, for example, Saturn and its moons or its rings or Jupiter and its moons may be, the real thing, there's a connection there, Art. I coined a term in the literature about a dozen years ago called the photon connection. And it's really caught on. It's something that I'm sure a child could understand that we sophisticated adults don't really think about. And the photon connection has nothing to do with Captain Photon or anything like that. But it's the realization that when you look at a star or a galaxy or a nebula, you're getting a piece of that object. With something that was inside that star has now entered your eye. And the reason I'm saying that is that we see things by photons. That's where the name came from, the photon connection. And as you know, Art, photons are both particles and waves. I like to look at them as particles moving in waves. Anyway, they have a very strange dualistic nature, behaving as both. Point is that a particle is something material. And I have looked at quasars with my Celestron telescope 3 billion light years out. I am getting pieces of that quasar that left there 3 billion years ago, traveled across the universe, and ended its journey on the retina of my eye. And it doesn't have to be that far away. Just standing on the beach or in your backyard looking at a star, you are getting something in your eye that was inside that star. And this is why people have all these transformative and enlightenment experiences stargazing. And nothing, no photograph, no computer image, nothing on television is going to match actually getting the photons in your eye.
You have a blog as Scientific's Sky Talk.
Okay, it's actually not my blog, but it you could consider it. I don't blog, but I do consulting for Edmund Scientific, who build telescopes and have for many, many years. And on their website I do a monthly column called Sky Talk. That's the correct name. You got it, Sky Talk. And it's about a 500-word, easy-to-read summary of what's going on in the sky that month. I touch on various. I've been doing this for 5 years now, touching on various topics related to telescopes and binoculars and things you can see with your eye, things you need a telescope for. So it's an easy fix on the sky for each month.
And that's at scientificsonline.com/scientifics-sky-talk.
Yes, I believe that is the correct address, and you can click on that, and there's something like 4 to 5 years' worth of them archived on there, and you can just click on them and bring them up to date. So it's like little astronomy primers. It's easy to read, and it doesn't take very long since they're only about 500 words each.
Now, I was wondering, which is the best type of telescope to start out with for an amateur, glass-lensed, conventional, or mirrored?
Okay. Well, Art, first of all, the thing we recommend most is to start out with a good pair of binoculars. just to get your bearings around the sky. And then eventually you want a telescope. And to be honest with you, most people jump right into a telescope. It's really good to have a pair of binoculars and a telescope. As I mentioned earlier, you don't need much magnification. There's three kinds of power to a telescope. The magnifying power, which is the least important, the light gathering power, which is the most important, how much light it picks up, and then the resolving power, how sharp the images are. And both, there's actually three kinds of telescopes. You hit two of them. There's the lens type glass telescope that's called the refractor, the thing that Galileo made famous. And then shortly after Galileo came along Isaac Newton, and he created the reflector, which uses parabolic or spherical mirrors in place of a glass front lens. And then in the mid-50s, a new breed of telescope came along, and that's what so many of the ones you see today, including the one I use. It's called a, where do you hear this, a Schmidt-Cassegrain catadioptric telescope. And what it essentially is, it's a marriage of a reflector, the mirror type, and a refractor, the lens type. And when you do this, you get a very compact telescope in a very small package. Art, I must tell you, I'll finish answering your question, but this little telescope, and I always tell folks at the lectures, don't let the size fool you. They were developed for the space program. The model I have has been up on the space shuttle many times. The telescope I have, on a clear night, on a good steady night, will show you the ARE complex in Virginia Beach. If you put it on the moon 250,000 miles away, you could look in and see it. It would be a dot, but you could see that. So,
wow.
Probably in starting out, the compound telescopes, the catadioptric optics, they are a little more expensive. You're paying for extra optics and the compactness. But a good lens-type telescope or a good reflecting telescope, good quality from a well-known manufacturer, that's the way to go. And you don't have to spend a fortune. For $100 or more, and normally in times past, you would only get junk for that because of the improvements in technology and manufacturing. For between $100 and $200, you can get a telescope that will last you a lifetime and show you wonders that you just won't believe. I always say that every family at least needs a telescope to be in touch with the universe. It's like not having a telephone or a television. Everyone should have a telescope.
Oh, yes.
I'm very evangelistic about that.
Oh, no, that's good.
Robert Frost said someone in every town should own a telescope. Owes it to the town, to have a telescope that they can look through.
And I'm going to have to test yours out when you come here.
Oh, yes. I hope it'll be a clear night. And, the views, if conditions are good, are just magnificent.
Wow. And I don't want to get, well, I don't know, I guess I'm getting kind of technical, but with the, I've only used the lens telescope. Just
the refractor,
conventional refractor.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't too much adjustment for focusing. I've heard that with the mirrored, or I don't know with about yours, but with yours, is there a lot more adjustment you have to do?
That type? I thought you meant focal adjustment. On refractors, the lens-type telescopes, the optics on both ends are set in the tube, the primary lens, the
side. Oh, yes.
Move around. So in a reflector, it is sitting at the bottom of the tube, and there's three adjusting screws, and they do occasionally need what's called collimation. Very simple process. I do it in 10 seconds if necessary, but as long as you haven't banged a telescope around or traveled over bumpy roads, it's not a major thing, and the instruction manuals are included with telescopes clearly cover this, but collimation is very important. And in the Schmidt-Cassegrains, there's also collimation needed from time to time. But I wouldn't let that scare you away. A reflector gives you good value for the money. You get a lot more aperture and seeing ability for the dollar with a reflector. It often used to be called the poor man's telescope. And most of us, I've built a dozen telescopes myself, and telescope making is a big field where you can actually make your own instruments.
And I just have one more question about the nature of the telescope. Does it have distortion, or when you look through it, is it a similar picture that you would see through a lensed telescope?
Oh, if they're optically well made, that is made to specifications, what's called diffraction limited, you can't tell the difference.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with James Mullaney, FRAS. And since we're almost out of time, do you have any final thoughts?
Well, my motto is keep looking up. Astronomy is not only an exhilarating hobby, and it's elevating to the spirit. And goodness knows, given the state of the world today, we can sure use inspiration and elevation. But I wanted to throw out on a philosophical note the fact that a telescope, and I'm glad you brought up telescopes. I didn't know we were even going to talk about them in this interview, and I'm glad we did. A telescope's not just another gadget you buy, like a VCR or a camera or whatever. A telescope is a wonderful, magical gift that's been given to mankind. It's a window on creation. It's a time machine, because the further out you look, the further back in time you're going. It's a mind expander. It's so many wonderful things. But Art, here's the kicker. A telescope may be the salvation of the human race. And I'm going to quote here from the dedication of what was once the largest telescope in the world, the famous telescope on Palomar Mountain, the 200-inch telescope in California. It's now becoming dwarfed by these larger instruments that are being built. But Art, at the dedication of that wonderful instrument, it's still in operation. I've been there twice. I actually hugged the instrument at one point, the mounting for it. It's like going to Mecca. Anyway, at the dedication of that telescope, one of the things was said there was this. Adrift in a cosmos whose shores he can't even imagine, man spends his energy in fighting with his fellow man over issues which a single look through this telescope would show to be utterly inconsequential. And Art, I would extend that to say any telescope. Give your neighbor, give family members, give passersby on the street their first look at the universe, no matter how modest your telescope is, and you can open up a whole new universe to them. And the more people that have that cosmic perspective that Carl Sagan always talked about, without that cosmic perspective, we're going to self-destruct. So that is so important, and that is a little-known virtue of the telescope itself. May I quote from the end of my own book? There's nothing like that, is there?
Oh, yeah, no, that sounds, that'd be
no,
good.
Because there's a reason for this, and here it is. I could just say this to you, but this is how I end Edgar Casey in the Cosmos, okay? I, for one, am eagerly looking forward to achieving our cosmic destiny. And I'll interject here the fact that we are destined to return to our source, to the stars. We're made of stardust. We came from the stars. We're going to go back there. Casey talked about this. But I, for one, am eagerly looking forward to achieving our cosmic destiny, along with countless others who've moved on from their last earthly reincarnations. Edgar Casey is surely waiting patiently for us on some world, in some form, out there among the lights in the night sky. I really can't wait to see him, because I want, first of all, to thank him personally for sharing his amazing psychic gift with us. And, as an astronomer, I also have a couple of thousand questions to ask him about the cosmos.
All right, well, thank you.
Well, thank you, Art. It's been a pleasure, and I hope you, and I know you do, and I hope the listeners will continue to keep looking up.
And now it's time for the Thought for the Day. And today's Thought for the Day will be read by Kimberly Rose. Kimberly Rose is the host of the radio show Interviews with Kimberly Rose on CBS Sky Radio on Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. She'll also be speaking at the upcoming conference, Be Your Own Psychic. It's the Edgar Casey Legacy, from October 19th to the 23rd at the ARE in Virginia Beach. To find out more, go to edgarcasey.org, click on Events, and then click on Conferences. Well, hello.
Hi, how are you?
And what's today's thought for the day?
I really, really love this because it's so true. It's so true, and it's something that I have hung up in my office. I like to hang things up that really help me as I begin my day. It's reading 1427-1. Then we would give that not only must the body mind turn to spiritual promises that are part of its mental and spiritual self, but the environment must be changed so that the spiritual promises may be put to active service and work to replace the habits with the habits of doing good, doing right, doing justice, being merciful. And to me, you know, we have our body mind, which, and we have then our body spirit, right? Our mind body. And then our, I always say that we, you know, our body is connected to our mind. And then we have our mind and body. We have our heart, body, the part of us that feels. The mind is the part that connects to the consciousness, the collective. But if we, you know, we can walk around and we can get all this stuff. We can be on cloud nine, receiving messages, things like that. But we're also here on Earth. And by taking care of the things around us, and like Edgar Cayce, I eat my almonds every day. You know, he gives some really things that are important, like exercise and honoring the things around you. You know, look at the animals, our plants, taking care and honoring that energy that is with you really makes it gives more light and more knowledge and more clarity so that we can truly embrace God in our lives.
This talks about also the environment must be changed. So this kind of talks about people with bad, or I guess we all can have bad habits, but one way to overcome those habits is to change your environment.
You know, my mom has on her wall, it says, if you want to heal the body, you must first heal the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, and Edgar Cayce talks about making the mind stronger.
Thanks for doing the thought for the day today.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show today. Thanks to James Mullaney, FRAS, for talking to us. If you want to order one of his DVDs, you can contact him at ArcturusSJ@AOL.com. That's ArcturusSJ@AOL.com. He is a key presenter at ARE's annual 2012 conference, A New Body, A New Mind, in Virginia Beach from July 15th to the 17th. To find out more, go to edgarcayce.org, click on events, and then click on conferences. Also, you can find James Mullaney's book, Edgar Cayce and the Cosmos, at the ARE Catalog at arecatalog.com. Thanks to Kimberly Rose for the thought for the day, and most of all to you, the listener. Thanks for listening to Reflections, the wisdom of Edgar Cayce.